And articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
True West, the history of the American frontier. From October 2020 issue. Western art in pandemics, then and now. Visitors to Wyoming's Bighorn Country will discover many of their favorite places open for business during the pandemic, albeit with some restrictions, including the Brenton Museum, which is offering free admission through 2020. Charles M. Russell's When Ropes Go Wrong is just one of the classic pieces of Western art that can be enjoyed on a tour of the Brenton, courtesy of the Brenton Museum. The time? November 1918 to January 1919, during the Spanish influenza pandemic. The place, Great Falls, Montana. The artist, Charles M. Russell. The cost, an estimated 675,000 American lives and at least 50 million across the world. Today, COVID-19 has put the American West art world in a new nightmare. The Blackhawk Museum of Danville, California is open for business and has an extensive exhibition space dedicated to the history and culture of the American West, including a major display of American Indian artisanship, such as the Sioux War Bonnet featured in the Spirit of the Old West Gallery, courtesy Blackhawk Museum. The pandemic has gotten so bad, the Board of Health orders theaters, churches, schools, dance halls, pool halls, and card rooms closed. Public gatherings are also prohibited. 2 months later, a local artist, in need of an editor, writes a friend, "This old sickness certainly trimmed this camp. Here's proof enough I just sold a picture to an undertaker." The time, November 1918 to January 1919. During the Spanish influenza pandemic. The place, Great Falls, Montana. The artist, Charles M. Russell. The cost, 675,000 American lives and at least 50 million across the world. Today, COVID-19 has put the American West art world in a new nightmare. Western art by Sedona, Arizona, cowboy artist James Derham celebrates the Old West's heritage with a twist of humor and whimsy, as illustrated by his acrylic painting, The Sheriff, courtesy of James Derham. Western art galleries have focused on online marketing, but selling art online is difficult. There is a generation gap opening up between younger collectors who are more comfortable purchasing art online and our older clientele who are not, says Maria Hajik, director of the Department of Naturalism and Contemporary Western Art at Gerald Peters Gallery in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It is the latter group that has supported and sustained the Western art market for decades. I still believe the art business is about personal connections, but that is changing. Arizona artist Sherry Blanchard Stewart has contributed to paint, market, and sell her Western art through the pandemic. Stewart's art celebrates the Old West, cowboys, and American Indian culture, as is evident in her classic Friendly Encounter, courtesy Sherry Blanchard Stewart. Western artist Robert Pace Kidd, who splits his time between California and Mexico, headed to the Baja Coast in February ahead of pandemic-forced safety measures. "I've been busy making art," he says. "Selling's a whole different matter. I don't know if anything's going to pick back up until there's a true vaccine," Comanche artist Nakona Burgess says. Visitors to Old Town's Scottsdale's Cowboy Legacy Gallery, Arizona, will discover the gallery open for business offering for sale one of the finest selections of Western collectibles, memorabilia, antiques, and modern artisan classics in the United States, courtesy of Cowboy Legacy Gallery. Laura Foster, director and curator of the Frederick Remington Art Museum in Ogdensburg, New York, flew to Spain in February to care for her sick mother. By the time her mother was well enough to travel, coronavirus-stricken Spain had rigorously locked down. Foster, interviewed by telephone in June, hoped to return to the museum by July. When I left, I was the only person abandoning their physical location for non-COVID reasons, she says, and then everyone else joined me with the physical distancing. Even those writing about art have been hit. The closing of museums and libraries during the current pandemic has certainly slowed research on Western art, says B. Byron Price, director of the Charles M. Russell Center for the Study of Art of the American West at the University of Oklahoma, who provided this article's Spanish flu information regarding Great Falls and Russell. When this pandemic ends remains uncertain, as does what the post-COVID Western art world will be. Unfortunately, there may be a thinning out of galleries, some museums, and even publications if the COVID pandemic persists longer than early 2021, says Mark Sublett, president of Mark Sublett Medicine Man Gallery in Tucson, Arizona. The J. Watson Fine Art Gallery of Van Nuys, California, has remained open for business during the pandemic and offers a broad selection of Western art for sale through its website, including artist Frank McCarthy's oil painting, The Chief, courtesy J. Watson Fine Art. Art museums must also figure out what to do with scheduled exhibits that never opened or were rarely seen because of COVID-19 restrictions. Will exhibits be rescheduled? Canceled? The Frederick Remington Art Museum loaned art for Natural Forces, Winslow Homer, and Frederick Remington, which was scheduled to open at the Denver Art Museum in March and travel to the Portland, Maine Museum of Art and the Amon Carter Museum of American Art in Fort Worth, Texas. We expect to announce that we are extending the loan to allow the tour to continue, Foster says, then adds, nothing really can be answered until the pandemic ends. Online presences will be a must, insiders predict, for post-pandemic galleries, museums, and artists. The days of merely waiting for clients to walk through the door to make a sale have seen their heyday, Sublett says. There is no turning back the clock. The time is now. Just like it was in 1918 to 1919, when the Spanish flu and World War I forced the Great Northern Railroad to withdraw a $5,800 commission, artist Maynard Dixon told friend Charles Loomis that he wasn't certain he'd keep his painting. Dixon was deeply depressed, says Sublett, author of Maynard Dixon's American West, Along the Distant Mesa. Loomis wrote Dixon back with words of encouragement, and Dixon was able to move forward. He did the illustrations for that year's Bohemian Grove, which I am sure gave him great solace. The takeaway is Dixon's painting career improved dramatically soon after the pandemic resolved, and he painted some of his best paintings over the next 20 years. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to closures or limited operating hours of many of America's museums, including Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West. Because of its closure, Western Spirit has extended Maynard Dixon's American West to August 3, 2021. One of the major pieces on loan from the Booth Western Art Museum is Dixon's mural-size masterpiece, Red Butte with Montana Men, 1935, a 95 by 213-inch oil on canvas. Courtesy Booth Western Art Museum, Cartersville, Georgia. Hopefully, as a country, we can look back at Dixon's ordeal and realize we too will have better days again. Long before COVID, Burgess reminds us, Comanches and other Indian tribes dealt with smallpox pandemics. At the first, the treatment was to sweat it out in a sweat lodge and then jump into cold water. Absolutely the worst thing you could do. Eventually, the Comanches and other tribes learned the best preventative, social distancing, Burgess says. They built separate camps for the sick. A form of art came from smallpox, too. Those red dresses you see decorated with white shells, he says, were worn by smallpox survivors. Kidd believes that just as Western artists came through the Spanish flu, World War I, the Great Depression, and other wars, disasters, and outbreaks, today's Western artists will do the same. Artists, he says, seem to find a way. A Thousand Texas Longhorns, a novel by Johnny D. Boggs about Nelson Story's 1866 cattle drive to Montana, is being published by Pinnacle this year.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing to read selections from True West magazine. I'll be reading some articles from the True West March 2019 edition. The Alamo Under Siege by Mark Boardman. For many baby boomers, the lasting image of the Alamo comes from the 50s, the 1950s. Fess Parker is the title character in Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. And the last view we have of him, Davy is on the roof of the church, out of bullets, swinging his rifle Old Betsy as a club, bravely and futilely holding off the Mexican hordes. Ignore the fact that Davy didn't die on the roof. There was no roof on the church, and no hump on the facade either. Davy's last stand was the symbol of heroism and the fight for freedom, and that church was the Alamo. Gary Foreman was one of the boomers who saw that show. Like so many, he was enthralled by the story and the place. Little did he know, at the time, that the Alamo would take a central point in his life, that in a figurative sense, he'd be making his own stand against ignorance and political and bureaucratical quagmires. It really kicked in nearly 27 years after the Disney program. A taxicab epiphany. There was one precise moment in time, April 3rd, 1982. I was photographing the Alamo Church while standing in the street directly in front. It was open to traffic then. And I was almost plowed over by a taxi, forcing me to jump to the curb. When I got up to comprehend what happened, a voice out of nowhere told me, "You need to do this." Hearing that voice changed the direction of my life and the direction of the Alamo. Foreman began serious study of the events and the place and discovered that the historic mission was more than just the surviving church and the long barracks. The modern Alamo is just one third of the compound from 1836. The mission had extended dozens of yards in each direction, across now modern streets and into newer buildings. He was angered that defenders died at spots now occupied by tourist attractions. Ripley's Believe It or Not Auditorium, Louis Tussaud's Wax Museum, and Guinness Book of World Records Museum stood on the Alamo Plaza, directly across from the Shrine of Liberty and Cenotaph Monument. So he began formulating plans and bending ears. This was more than a project. It was a calling, a quest, and the voice that had spoken to him wouldn't shut up. Foreman's vision wasn't exactly welcomed when he presented it in 1984. Peggy Dibrell, chair of the Alamo Committee of the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, was dismissive. "Mr. Foreman doesn't understand that this is a sacred shrine. He wants to turn the Alamo into a tourist trap," she said. "Besides, Mr. Foreman is not a Texan." That's true. Foreman and his wife are based in the Chicago area. But there were many of people, in Texas and beyond, who were and are just as concerned about the shrine, not only as a symbol of Texas liberty, but also as a monument to men who were willing to sacrifice their lives in the service of freedom. It's a universal message that attracts around 1.7 million visitors annually from around the world. A voice in the darkness. But that universal idea didn't catch fire, even locally. Gary and Carolyn Foreman, she organized research and other documents and provided a kinder, gentler voice to the campaign, spent most of their time at Native Son Productions, their documentary film business. As they could, they preached the gospel of the reborn Alamo, using displays, graphics, maps, and battlefield tours to get the word out. And many heard his call, including Fess Parker, the Davy Crockett who first introduced the Alamo to Foreman, and later musician Phil Collins, who, like Foreman, owed his passion for the mission to the Disney series in the 1950s. But hearing is not necessarily acting. Nothing happened for nearly 25 years. At that point, the renewal of the Alamo came front and center. So what changed? Why did so many groups agree to, mostly, put aside their differences and transform the Alamo? No surprise, there's no agreement on that. Gary Foreman says his 2006 documentary, Alamo Plaza, A Star Reborn, was the catalyst. Others say it was the state's 2015 decision to boot the Daughters of the Republic of Texas from its role as caretaker of the Alamo after more than a century. The DRT was accused of neglecting Alamo maintenance and misusing funds, which the organization denies. Some give credit to Texas Land Commissioner George P. Bush, who staked his political credibility on rebuilding the Alamo. Still others believe it was a decision by state and local governments to cooperate, finally, on plans to preserve and expand the Alamo. The project gains momentum. Whatever. Over the last 4 years, various commissions and committees have come up with proposals. Several remarkably close to what Gary Foreman put forth years ago. The city of San Antonio is leasing the historic site from the state of Texas for 50 years at no cost, with two 25-year extensions after that. And last November, the city council approved a $450 million renovation project. The state will kick in $106 million. The city will provide $38 million, and the rest will come from nonprofits. If all goes as planned, the work will be done in 2024, the 300th anniversary of the mission San Antonio de Valero, the origins of the Alamo. Interestingly, Foreman was not included on any of those committees. Make no mistake, most folks know just what he's done, including Alamo CEO Douglas McDonald. Gary Foreman has been the persistent visionary who has challenged everyone to understand that the Alamo story is a large, historical narrative on a marginalized site. He has inspired and tormented others to think larger. The Alamo appreciates his engagement, counsel, and passion. Yes, McDonald said tormented. Others, at least in private, say Foreman has done himself no favors. One Alamo booster says he could be arrogant and abrasive, which turned off many people. And as a result, it was nearly impossible to gain political support for the project. Other forces took up the banner at that point, and they've reached a point where victory is in sight. For his part, Foreman is of two minds. He's pleased and proud of what he and others have accomplished. At the same time, he can't relax. He's still fighting over the possible location of the planned museum and worries that the Alamo could become an urban park, not a true historical site. Those who don't see things his way? Tiny provincial minds who are afraid of change, he says. For Gary Foreman, the battle isn't over. He still stands on his parapets, clubbing the enemy with the long rifle of his passion, determined to win total victory or go down trying. Davy Crockett, or Fess Parker, would understand. Mark Boardman is the features editor at True West and editor of the Tombstone Epitaph. I'm going to move to another edition of the magazine for one story that relates to the previous article. This story was published in True West in April 2020. Restore the Alamo by Mark Boardman. Gary Foreman is in a new phase of life. Some good, some not so good, much yet to be determined. But the man who is the visionary behind the Alamo Restoration Project, the effort to return the mission to its 1836 configuration, seems a bit calmer these days. Some of it is personal. A few months ago, his wife, Carolyn Rain Foreman, died after a long illness. She had been the kinder and gentler force on the Alamo Project, balancing out Gary's insistence, persistence, and pushiness. Gary seems more contemplative, more thoughtful in conversation. Or maybe it's because his vision, at least part of it, is finally becoming reality, some 38 years after it came to him on a visit to the Alamo. The project's phase one is now underway. Included in that are street closures around the Crockett and Minger hotels to the south of the mission. Parts of Bonham Street, located behind the area, will be widened. Landscape design, architecture, and lighting will be installed on the south end of Alamo Plaza from Crockett Street to the mall. And the massive cenotaph, located in the plaza, will be restored. All of that should be done by the fall of this year. That means larger parts of the project, including moving the cenotaph, tearing down buildings to the west of the Alamo, and building a museum, are still in the future. And it's those plans that still draw most of the opposition. Members of the Conservation Society of San Antonio, along with some black groups, want the Woolworth Building saved. It's located just west, across the street from the current plaza. But in 1836, that spot was part of the western wall of the Alamo. Built in 1921, the building has a history of its own. In 1960, it had one of the first lunch counters in the South to desegregate. Supporters want that history preserved and honored. But the interior of the Woolworth is in bad shape and would require massive work to restore it to its former appearance. San Antonio City Councilman Roberto Trevino, who's on the Alamo Master Plan Committee, says, "We have an agreement with the Alamo Museum to make sure we tell the history of the Woolworth Building and how it played a critical role in the civil rights story of San Antonio." So far, that still hasn't placated those who want to keep the Woolworth Building from facing the wrecking ball. In November, three sets of human remains were found during archaeological digs at the Alamo. As of this writing, tests are continuing to determine how old they are and to what ethnicity they belong. Soon after, leaders of the Tap, Pilum, Coahuiltecan Nation filed suit to stop any construction at the site and instead to focus work on finding any more remains on the premises. The Tap, Pilum believe that there could be a large number of Indians buried at the mission, which served local tribes for much of the 1700s. But there's a problem. The Tap Pilum is not a federally recognized Indian tribe, so it lacks standing in court proceedings, and it has not been proven that the remains are, in fact, Indians. It should be noted that an Alamo Archaeological Committee overseeing the treatment of human remains found during digs includes members of federally recognized tribes. None of those groups have sought to stop work on the project. The Alamo Defenders Descendants Association has filed suit and held protests to keep the cenotaph where it is. The monument, which was built and dedicated on the centennial of the battle, honors all of those killed in the fight. The ADDA says that the cenotaph is basically a headstone, marking the graves of some of the heroes of the Alamo. Supporters of the project deny that, saying all of the defenders' bodies were burned and the ashes taken away. Lee White of the ADDA says the entire Alamo area should be treated as a cemetery. He fears that the reclamation project will turn it into an urban park. It should be noted that part of Phase 1 calls for the cenotaph to be restored. It's had little work done since its construction, and for the list of names on it to be corrected. Some were inadvertently left off. But even with all of those bumps in the road, the Alamo Project is off and running. Alamo Trust CEO Douglas McDonald says this is the home stretch where we will actualize our goal of making Alamo Plaza a more reverent space to better honor the Alamo defenders. The plan is progressing as expected and is on track to be completed by 2024, in time for the 300th anniversary of the Alamo mission moving to where it is today. Texans and visitors from all around the world will experience a world-class historic site that tells the whole story of the Alamo, where history happened. And as for Gary Foreman, the instigator, the burr under the saddle, the person Doug McDonald once called tormented, he hasn't totally mellowed. He still wants the proposed museum to be located in the old post office building, located northwest of the plaza. He's fighting the proposal to locate it to the west, where the Crockett Block now stands. When he talks about that, some of the old Foreman fire comes out again. But now he also talks about bringing people together. As we see this enter a higher professional realm, I think there will be a lot of people that will understand the interconnectedness of everything, whether it be religion or military or economic or whatever. And that's where we start healing, when we see it that way. Perhaps for Gary Foreman, the healing has already started. Now I'm actually going to read one more article from this April 2020 edition of True West. Again, this is related to the Alamo. And Die Like a Soldier, by William Groneman III. 27-year-old William Barrett Travis carried considerable weight on his shoulders in the wee morning hours of March 6, 1836. The native South Carolinian had immigrated from Alabama to the Mexican side of Coahuila y Tejas 5 years earlier for a new beginning. Now in the Alamo, a former Franciscan mission serving as a fort, he may have contemplated his impending end rather than a beginning. Travis held the rank of lieutenant colonel in Texas's newly formed cavalry, yet he commanded a fortification, a job more suited to an artillery officer. He had shared leadership with Colonel James Bowie at the beginning of the siege, but illness rendered the frontiersman bedridden early on, leaving Travis in full command. Travis penned his famous letter of February 24, 1836, the same day as Bowie's incapacitation, addressed to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world. He stated his intention to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due to his own honor and that of his country, if Texas neglected his calls for assistance. He had sustained himself and his garrison for 12 days. Now the time had come to fulfill his pledge to honor and country. Alamo historians and aficionados have debated the finer details of the battle for decades. Two of the more spirited subjects involve the exact manner in which the American icons Bowie and Davy Crockett met their ends, approximately 9 and 25 versions, respectively. Less attention has been paid to the exact mechanism, time, and place of Travis's demise. However, speculation and questions surrounding his death began within a week of the battle. Word of the Alamo's fall reached Sam Houston in the town of Gonzales, 70 miles east of San Antonio, on March 11, 1836, by Tejanos Anselmo Vargara and Andre Bersinas. They had not witnessed the battle themselves, but reported information from an Antonio Perez. There is no evidence that Perez witnessed the fight, since he rode from the ranch of Jose Maria Arocha to San Antonio on March 6th, the morning of the battle. Whatever information Vargara and Barcinas shared caused their detention by Houston, possibly for fear of them being spies of Santa Anna, but more likely to stave off panic among the assembling Texans. Their information sparked stories of Travis dying as a suicide. E.N. Gray stated in his March 11th letter, "Travis killed himself." Andrew Briscoe, writing to the Red River Herald, provided a reason for Travis's suicide. The brave and gallant Travis, in order to save himself from falling into the hands of the enemy, shot himself. Details shifted during the next few days. Houston reported that Travis, rather than fall into the hands of the enemy, stabbed himself. Benjamin Briggs Goodrich, whose brother John died at the Alamo, wrote on March 15th, "Colonel Travis, the commander of the fortress, sooner than fall into the hands of the enemy, stabbed himself to the heart and instantly died." The story evolved, however. 5 days later, in Nacogdoches, Texas, John T. Mason wrote to a Major Nelson, commanding Fort Jessup in the United States, "Travis and all his men were captured and murdered." E. Boker, writing from St. Augustine, Texas, a week later, assured a relation, "Colonel Travis, the commander of that little band, was found dead, grappled with a Mexican officer, with his sword through his body." Leaving unsaid whose sword went through whose body. The man able to clear up the mystery, Travis's slave, Joe, who arrived in Gonzales two days after Vergara and Barcenas, had another story to tell. He came to the Texan forces with Susanna Dickinson and her young daughter, all three survivors from the Alamo. He later described the battle to Texan officials at Washington on the Brazos. Several witnesses recorded his account, embellished it, and passed it on to a number of newspapers in the United States. George C. Childress, former editor of the Nashville Banner, reported that Travis had been awakened in the early morning hours of March 6th by a cry from the guard on the wall. "Colonel Travis, the Mexicans are coming." Travis sprang from his blanket, grabbed his double-barreled gun and sword, and with Joe, mounted one of the ramparts. The fast-moving enemy already had placed scaling ladders against the wall. Travis fired his gun on them and immediately suffered a gunshot wound in return. He fell within the fort, while his gun fell among the Mexican soldiers. Childress further stated that a Mexican general leading his troops over the wall attempted to behead Travis, but the wounded colonel raised his sword and killed the general. Joe retreated to one of the rooms of the Alamo and thus survived the slaughter. The presentation of this account makes it seem as if Joe witnessed the final death struggle between Travis and the general. However, later on it states that an English-speaking Mexican officer and Santa Anna himself made Joe point out Travis's body. Only through their conversation did Joe come to believe that Travis killed a Mexican officer, and this only because their bodies were close enough that their blood then congealed together. No actual witness is cited to confirm this last defiant act by Travis. Other participants, or claimed participants of the battle, left statements regarding Travis's death over the years, compounding the mystery. The earliest appeared in a newspaper, El Mosquito Mexicano, on April 5, 1836, as part of an account by an unidentified Mexican soldier. It merely stated the chief, they called Travis, died like a brave man with his gun in his hand in back of a cannon. He did not say that he actually witnessed the death. 24 years later, Francisco Ruiz, who claimed to be the Alcalde of San Antonio in 1836, stated for the Texas Almanac of 1860 that he had been called upon to identify Travis's body for the Mexicans. He said, "On the north battery of the fortress lay the lifeless body of Colonel Travis on the gun carriage, shot only in the forehead." Filmmakers and artists have loved this touch, giving their Travis character or image a neat little red spot on his forehead, indicating a bullet wound. Some historians, while constructing a dramatic telling of the Alamo story, have melded Ruiz's words with those of Joe, giving the impression that Joe witnessed Travis being felled by a single shot to the forehead. Had Travis been smacked in the forehead with a Mexican Army musket ball approaching 69 caliber, it is very unlikely that he would have been in any condition later for a death struggle with a Mexican officer. Many Alamo historians accept Ruiz's story at face value without further investigation. The late Thomas Ricks Lindley, in his book Alamo Traces, 2003, presents evidence showing that Ruiz may not have been in San Antonio during the battle. Susanna Dickinson, in 1875, stated that Colonels Travis and James Butler Bonham were killed while operating the cannon. The body of the former lay on top of the church. That same year, Francisco Becerra, believed to have been a Mexican sergeant in the battle, related a story in which Mexican soldiers found Travis and Davy Crockett indoors. Travis seized a gun's bayonet pointed at him and depressed the muzzle to the floor. Other soldiers opened fire, and a bullet struck Travis in the back. He then stood erect, folding his arms, and looked calmly, unflinchingly, upon his assailants. He was finally killed by a ball passing through his neck. Becerra went on to say that Crockett stood in a similar position, and they died, undaunted, like heroes. An 1889 article in the Fort Worth Gazette cited Felix Nunez, who claimed Travis manned a cannon just outside the open door of the Alamo Church. Mexican cannon and small arms fire silenced the Texan gun and killed Travis. 10 years later, newspapers cited the celebrated Madame Candelaria after her death on February 10, 1899, stating, Colonel Travis was the first man killed. He fell on the southeast side near where the Minger Hotel stands. Alamo historians today argue Candelaria's presence in the fort during the battle. Her ever-changing tales of the Alamo include three versions of Bowie's death and two wildly variant death scenes for Crockett. Travis lacked the star power and legendary image of a Jim Bowie or Davy Crockett. His last moments never excited the same controversy or curiosity as those of the other two Alamo heroes. However, the conflicting accounts by eyewitnesses, or claimed eyewitnesses, still provide enough mystery to spark conversation as to how and where he died. Joe, the only survivor with Travis during the battle, provides the best bet on his transition into eternity. He fired his double-barreled gun and immediately fell to enemy fire, one of the earliest Texan casualties of the battle. Travis held the Alamo garrison together during two grueling weeks of siege. He did not lead from the rear during the final fray, but mounted the walls to face his enemy, never forgetting his own honor or that of his country. He fulfilled his promise to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world, and died like a soldier. Travis's pleas for help. Travis's second letter from the Alamo, written on February 24, 1836, is famous for its closing salutation, victory or death. Transcription courtesy William Groneman. Commandancy of the Alamo, Bejar, February 24, 1836. To the people of Texas and all Americans in the world, fellow citizens and compatriots. I am besieged by 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Anna. I have sustained a continual bombardment and cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword. If the fort is taken, I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. Then I call on you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character to come to our aid with all dispatch. The enemy is receiving reinforcements daily and will no doubt increase to 3,000 or 4,000 in 4 or 5 days. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due to his own honor and that of his country. Victory or death. William Barrett Travis, Lieutenant Colonel Commander. P.S. The Lord is on our side. When the enemy appeared in sight, we had not 3 bushels of corn. We have since found in deserted houses 80 or 90 bushels and got into the walls 20 or 30 head of beeves. Travis. The day before Travis's famous letter to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world, he sent an initial call for aid from the Alamo on February 23, 1836. Commandancy of the Bear, February 23rd, 3 o'clock p.m., 1836. To Andrew Ponton, Judge and Citizens of Gonzales, February 23rd, 1836. The enemy in large force are in sight. We want men and provisions. Send them to us. We have 150 men and are determined to defend the Alamo to the last. Give us assistance. William Groneman is a former New York City firefighter and a sustaining member of Western Writers of America. He writes about the Alamo, Davy Crockett, John Steinbeck, and the FDNY. He received the Western Writers of America's Branding Iron Award in 2019. Now returning to the True West edition of March 2019. Women of the Alamo by William Groneman III. We remember the Alamo siege and battle for the men who died there. Not as well remembered are their families who endured the 13-day siege and final battle alongside them. Gunfire had barely ceased in and around the Alamo on the morning of March 6, 1836, when Mexican soldiers gathered a group of traumatized, frightened women and children and led them from the fort. Facts about the Alamo survivors have blurred over the years due to conflicting accounts, editorializing by interviewers, failing memories, and some hostilities among certain survivors. Most of the women and their children endured the battle in a back room of the Alamo Church. A few sheltered in other parts of the fort. Most were lucky enough to have lived through the early morning fight. Susanna Dickinson receives the most attention as a survivor of the Alamo. Many early newspaper articles and historians incorrectly recorded her as the sole survivor. Wife of artillery officer Almarin Dickinson, she survived the battle with her young daughter, Angelina. Susanna left a number of conflicting accounts of the Alamo over the years, which keep Alamo historians scratching their heads to this day. She remembered her husband rushing into the room to inform her that the Mexicans were inside the walls. He implored her to save their child if the enemy spared her. He returned to the fight, and she never saw him alive again. In a later account, she told of 17-year-old Galba Fukua of Gonzales running into her room to convey a message to her. Unfortunately, he could not speak since a bullet had broken his jaw. After several attempts, he rushed back to the battle. Susanna left stories of seeing one or more of the Alamo garrison and maybe 2 young boys bayoneted to death after they sought shelter in the non-combatants' room. Names and numbers vary in her accounts. She may have witnessed her husband's body being bayoneted by the Mexican soldiers and may have been wounded in her calf by a stray bullet as she left the Alamo Church after the battle. She, along with Joe, the slave of Alamo commander William Barrett Travis, later verified the news of the Alamo's fall to General Sam Houston. Susanna lived out her life in Texas, marrying 4 times. She and her last husband, Joseph W. Hannig, prospered in real estate and other enterprises in Austin in the 1870s. She died there on October 7, 1883, at the age of 68. Anna Salazar Esparza, wife of Private Jose Maria Gregorio Esparza, along with four, possibly five children, sheltered in the same room of the Alamo Church as Susanna Dickinson. The Esparzas entered the Alamo at twilight on the first day of the siege. Her story comes to us from several interviews given years later by her oldest son, Enrique. As with the Dickinson accounts, the stories conflict, and it remains unclear whether the Esparzas had an infant daughter with them in the fort. Enrique mentions an infant in some accounts. In others, he mentions an older, 10-year-old half-sister, Maria de Jesus Castro, by his mother's previous marriage to Victor de Castro. Besides Enrique and Maria, Anna had the care and safety of her other sons, Manuel and Francisco, and possibly the infant daughter, on her mind throughout the 13-day siege. Mexican soldiers took Anna and her family, along with most of the other survivors, to the house of Ramon Musquiz of San Antonio and placed them under guard. At about 8 o'clock in the morning, Anna defied the guards and rummaged about the Musquiz house for food to feed her hungry children and other survivors. A very jumpy Señor Musquiz convinced her to stay put and provided food for his guests. It is said that after the release of her family, Anna returned to her home and wept for many days. She passed away on December 12, 1847. Juana Navarro Perez Alsbury, her younger sister, Gertrudis Navarro, and Juana's 11-month-old son, Alejo Perez Jr., probably entered the Alamo under the protection of Jim Bowie, they being the cousins of his late wife, Ursula Veramendi. Juana, who had recently lost her first husband and possibly a young son, Encarnacion, to cholera, married Dr. Horace A. Alsbury in January 1836. Bowie sent Alsbury from San Antonio on a scouting mission, or to drum up reinforcements for the garrison. During the siege, Juana and her small family occupied a room along the Alamo's west wall, apart from the other women and children. As Mexican troops cleared room after room on the morning of battle, Juana directed Gertrudis to open their door to show the soldiers that women and children were present. A soldier grabbed Gertrudis' shawl and pursued her into the room, demanding her money or her husband. She cried that she had neither, as the soldiers ransacked the room, taking money and personal possessions left there for safekeeping by some of the Alamo's officers. Juana described a man named Mitchell running into the room to protect her and her sister. She also recalled a young Tejano defender run in seeking shelter. Both died by bayonets before her eyes. A Mexican officer entered the room and took the terrified young ladies and baby outside, where the battle raged. As things quieted, they cautiously made their way back to the room, but were hailed by a Mexican soldier, the brother of Juana's late husband, who took them into his protection. She and Horace Alsbury reunited in May 1836, following the Texans' April 21, 1836 victory over Santa Ana at San Jacinto. Alsbury died in the Mexican War in 1847, and Juana married again, this time to her first husband's cousin, Juan Perez. She passed away on July 25, 1888. Her son, Alejo Perez, holds the distinction as the longest living known survivor of the Alamo battle. He became a member of the San Antonio Police Department, lived until 1918, and died at the age of 83. 19-year-old Gertrudis Navarro survived the battle with her sister. 5 years later, she married Jose Miguel Felipe Cantu and lived the next half century in San Antonio. She died in April 1895. 40 years after the Alamo's fall, Susanna Hannig Dickinson reported somewhat bitterly that Juana and Gertrudis escaped to the enemy during the siege, about 2 days before the battle, and betrayed the condition of the garrison. This accusation has never been verified. Concepcion Charlie Gotare Lozoya had lived in the southwest corner of the Alamo compound in her younger years. Her son, Jose Toribio Lozoya, served in the Alamo garrison. She, her younger son Juan, and daughter Juana Francisca may have entered the Alamo under the protection of the garrison's quartermaster, Eliel Melton, Francisca's husband. Toribio's wife and child found shelter in town upon the Mexican army's arrival. Enrique Esparza, entering the Alamo with his family, remembered Francesca Melton drawing circles on the ground with an umbrella. The image remained vivid in his memory, since he had seen very few umbrellas. Elio Melton, a merchant before his military service, possibly had access to such exotic objects as umbrellas. Esparza added that following the battle and before the survivors were brought before Santa Anna, Francisca, through her brother Juan, asked Anna Esparza not to reveal to Santa Anna that she had married an American. Anna reassured her and told her not to be afraid. Esparza always remained a bit indignant about this, since she felt that Francisca looked down on his mother and never acknowledged her in the past. He remembered a Victoriana de Salinas and three small daughters as surviving the battle, but provided no further details on this family or why they were in the Alamo. He only stated that he remained acquainted with two of the girls in later life. Petra Gonzalez, an older woman known as Doña Petra to Esparza, may have been a relative of Anna Esparza. Both her paternal grandmother and her maternal grandfather were named Gonzalez. Esparza also identified a young girl, Trinidad Saucedo, as being with Doña Petra and described her as very beautiful in an interview in 1907. In an earlier 1902 interview, he stated that she left the Alamo during an armistice in the siege. A census report of Bear Barrio del Norte, March 19, 1826, lists a Trinidad Saucedo as a 17-year-old servant in the household of Don Juan de Veramendi, and Josefa Navarro, the family who raised Juana Navarro Perez Alsbury. This Trinidad, 27 at the time of the battle, may have entered the Alamo with Alsbury and her sister. Another census report of Bear Barrio, Sur, July 9, 1830, lists a 16-year-old Trinidad Saucedo in the household of Don Erasmo Seguin, making her 22 years old at the time of the battle. Erasmo's son, Captain Juan N. Seguin, served as an officer of the Alamo garrison until sent out by Travis for reinforcements, the highest-ranking officer to have left the Alamo during the siege. Trinidad of the Seguin household may have been the one remembered by Esparza. William Neal, 1807 to 1896, a former mayor of Brownsville, Texas, told the story of Betty to Texas Ranger and historian John S. Ford. He related that Betty, a black slave who claimed to have been Jim Bowie's cook, arrived at Matamoros, Mexico, with the Mexican army after the Battle of San Jacinto. Neal hired her, and she remained with him for 1 or 2 years. According to Neal, Betty survived the Alamo along with a male slave, Charlie, in the kitchen of the Alamo. After her time with Neal, fearful that she would be carried back to Texas in slavery, Betty disappeared into Monterey when Texan warships cruised near the mouth of the Rio Grande. In his memoirs, John S. Rip Ford also related an account by Juana Alsbury in which she stated that after the battle, she and her sister Gertrudis were placed in the charge of a colored woman belonging to Colonel Bowie, and the party reached the house of Don Angel Navarro in safety. Could this have been Betty? Finally, Joe, Travis's slave, reported that one woman died in the Alamo battle. A correspondent for the Frankfort, Kentucky Commonwealth stated in a May 25, 1836 letter, only one of the Negroes was killed, a woman who was found lying dead between two guns. Joe supposes she ran out in her fright and was killed by a chance shot. Independent research by Ron Jackson and the late Thomas Ricks Lindley provide possible identification of this victim. Ezekiel Hayes petitioned Mexico six times in 1831 and 32 for the return of a young mulatto slave named Sarah. According to his petitions, she ran off to Texas with Patrick Henry Herndon. Herndon likely rode to the Alamo with the men under Jim Bowie. He died there, possibly with Sarah, the only couple to have lost their lives together at the Alamo. The women survivors, along with their children, appeared before Santa Anna after the battle. He interviewed them, gave each two silver dollars and a blanket, and released them. These little remembered participants of a well-remembered battle. Now here's the column, Ask the Marshal. Can you tell me what version of the Winchester 73 Jimmy Stewart used in the movie of the same name? John Charles, Vestavia, Alabama. True West Firearms Editor Phil Spangenberger says the Winchester Company reconditioned three 1873 24-inch rifles, one of 1,000. At least one was a 38-40 because it could fire the 5-1 blanks they were using at the time. During the shooting contest scenes, the legendary Herb Parsons, also known as the Wizard of Winchester, stood just off camera with his own Model 71 lever-action rifle. Using live ammunition, he put a hole in the metal disc to give it a touch of realism. At the Cody Firearms Museum in Cody, Wyoming, you can see Parsons' 71 Winchester, which has a metal disc with a hole embedded in the stock. The stock also features the autographs of Jimmy Stewart and other members of the cast. What was the availability of eyeglasses like in the Old West? Emily Downey, Mission Viejo, California. Corrective eyeglasses have been around for hundreds of years, dating back to the 13th century. Benjamin Franklin is usually credited with inventing bifocals in the 1700s. Yep, they were available, often by mail order, in all but the most remote areas. Did cowboys use gloves in their work? Ralph D. Hart, Centerville, Texas. Leather gloves were an essential part of a cowboy's attire. These protected the hands from rope burns, blisters, brush, and hot branding irons. He also wore leather cuffs. These protected his wrists from rope burns and kept his lower shirt sleeves from wear and tear. Of all the TV westerns from the 1950s and 60s, which was the most realistic in terms of scenery, clothing, and dialogue? Bob Powers, Cincinnati, Ohio. I missed some of the earlier ones since we didn't have a TV. I don't think any of them wins a prize for authentic clothing or set design. They didn't look like they had spent much time outdoors. All that being said, I believe the best television show for creative writing, content, and storyline is Gunsmoke, followed closely by Have Gun Will Travel. Did Old West gunfighters really tie down their holsters? Tom Sakely, Warren, Michigan. Most experts say a tie-down Buscadero rig was a 20th century Hollywood creation. It looked cool, and the fast draw guys could have shootouts. Photos indicate there were some exceptions, but that's just what they were. Traditionally, the most common holster in the Old West was the Mexican loop, where the holster flap goes over the top of the belt and is loose. It doesn't need a tie-down. Truth is, the pistol waist-high or slightly below enables a shootist to get the gun in action faster than a low-slung Buscadero. Besides, those Hollywood-style shootouts, a staple in the movies, were very rare in the real West. Horses rarely get shot in the Westerns, although they often go down when the rider is hit. What about in real life? Robert Lucas, Carson City, Nevada. Horses suffered heavy casualties in warfare of any kind. They presented large targets, and bullets were flying in all directions. Also, shooters would fire at horses to get the rider on the ground and more vulnerable. With the advent of machine guns and barbed wire in the 20th century, armored vehicles soon replaced the horse cavalry.